The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My concern is what the president is doing is telling everybody in the world, don't trust the United States. Don't enter into an agreement with the United States unless it has an explicit provision in it that says it will take an act of Congress to get into this agreement and it will take an act of Congress to get out. That is really my concern, is that if you step back from what the Trump administration is doing, is it's undermining any trust or confidence that anybody has that they can take the United States' word for it. And I think, secondly, it is undermining the sense that participation in terms of exerting leadership by the United States in any multilateral forum can be counted on. That the United States can count, that you can count on the United States to assume a leadership role as the world's largest economy, as the largest superpower in the world. We should be the leader at NATO. We should be the leader in the United Nations. We should be the leader at the WTO, and we're not.
I'm Shannon Tagawa Mercer, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, July 21st, 2018. The Trump administration has taken an aggressive stance on U.S. trade relations, opting for bilateral negotiations and, in many cases, eschewing the multilateral trade order. The administration's collapsing the distinction between economic security and national security, and this has been painfully apparent in our trade war with China. Tensions with China are escalating. To hash it all out, on Tuesday, I spoke to Jennifer Hillman, former World Trade Organization appellate body member, commissioner on the United States International Trade Commission, general counsel at the United States Trade Representative, and Clark Packard, Trade Policy Counsel at the R Street Institute. We talked about China, the WTO, and this administration's incoherent trade strategy. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 331, Jennifer Hillman and Clark Packard on Trade and National Security, Part 2. I'm pleased to have with me here Professor Jennifer Hillman from Georgetown Law and Clark Packard from the R Street Institute on this, our second Lawfare Trade Podcast. So as many of you remember, our first podcast on the burgeoning trade national security issues was on June 9th, and we had Soumaya Keynes from The Economist and Dr. Megan Reese from R Street. Today, we have two accomplished and experienced trade lawyers to talk to us about all of the developments since June 9th, and specifically to talk about our relationship with China and how that's evolving quickly over what is known to many of us colloquially as the trade war. So first, Professor Hillman, I read your testimony before the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission on June 8th about how to best address Chinese unfair trade practices. And I think you're probably an excellent person to give us a rundown of where we are with China right now. So we see in the news just constant escalation of tariff threats and WTO filings. But what's the synthesis?
Well, I think the synthesis of what I was arguing before the U.S.-China Commission is, of all of the areas of policy where the United States should not be going alone, it's China, for a number of reasons. First and foremost, we don't have enough power to get China to make a change by itself. Second of all, the range of issues that we really need to confront China on is so broad that we need to be working with all of our trading partners and our allies on a collective approach to China. And thirdly, I think the key with China is that they will retaliate. And if you go at China as a large coalition, you create somewhat of a shield for U.S. companies and U.S. industries against that China retaliation. So the point I was making before the U.S.-China Commission is we need to put together a big, broad coalition of countries to bring a very deep and broad case at the World Trade Organization challenging China's practices across a range of issues.
And that's exactly not what we're doing, right?
And that is exactly not what we are doing. So right now we are all by ourselves. We have imposed unilateral tariffs on China under the auspices of this Section 301 law. And the double problem with it is before we imposed these unilateral tariffs on China, we imposed tariffs on all of our friends and allies that we need and should be bringing into this coalition to bring a case on China. So we instead imposed steel and aluminum tariffs on everyone in the world other than four countries that have been let out of those tariffs. So in other words, all of our largest, staunchest friends and allies, the European Union, Canada, Mexico, Japan, they've all been hit by these steel and aluminum tariffs, which has obviously both focused their attention on pushing back against the United States and these tariffs on the one hand, and on the other hand has diverted them from joining a U.S. coalition to go after China.
And one of the things I find most confusing about this is exactly what you just mentioned. It's the proliferation of different penalties that we're levying unilaterally against China and then separately against our allies. I think it would be useful for our listeners, maybe Clark, you could talk to us about the different kinds of tariffs that are just being aggregated into this aggressive economic move.
Yeah, Professor Hillman hit it right on the head there, that we have sort of a bifurcated approach. On one hand, we're being very aggressive, hitting our allies with Section 232 under sort of a national security argument, and then making a separate claim under Section 301. And Section 301 is unique among trade statutes in that it's not the purpose of the statute is not to prevent imports. It's to give the United States leverage to open up markets abroad and send exports abroad. But, you know, I think she's exactly right. One thing I would add, though, is I testified before the United States Trade Representative, and I made sort of a similar argument to the one Professor Hillman made before the U.S.-China Commission, but with a slight nuance in that I argued there that I don't think the United States has the legal authority under Section 301 to be acting unilaterally. If you go back and look at the history of, you know, the Uruguay Round Agreements Act. Basically, there was this thing called a grand bargain between the United States and the European Commission, whereby the European Commission agreed to binding dispute settlement, and the United States agreed to give up unilateral enforcement under Section 301. And so, in some respects, we're sort of dusting off a relic trade statute that really hasn't been used much. And I think we're sort of marching down a pretty dangerous and questionable legal path.
And on June 10th, the U.S. threatened additional tariffs justified under 301 on a proposed $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. Professor Hillman, the sort of re-upping of a 301 justification in this second round or this escalation of tariff threats, is that what's your perspective on that as a trade lawyer?
Well, again, you start with whether or not you had the authority to impose even the first set. And I would certainly not disagree that this can be highly questioned, whether or not the mere existence of a finding under 301 gives you the right to engage in unilateral tariff measures. Obviously, the first thing that happened even after that first round of tariffs went into place is China challenged the United States at the WTO. And the basic gist of China's challenge is twofold. First, the challenge is a violation of the very first article of the GATT, Article 1, which says most favored nation, which means to the extent that you are imposing tariffs, you need to impose them equally across all members of the WTO. But these 301 tariffs were targeted solely on China. So that was a violation. And then secondly, the second article of the GATT is that you will not charge tariffs that are in excess of the rates that you bound into your tariff schedule. And by imposing these 25% tariffs on this range, again, it started at $46 billion and then potentially an additional $200 billion of trade subject to those are tariffs on top of those that are in our binding. So they also violate Article 2 of the GATT. So again, China has immediately come back and said, no, this unilateral action by the United States is a violation of the United States' commitments under the WTO. And to some degree, what you're hearing, I think, is a lot of what Clark was saying, is this argument being made by the United States trade representative that, in essence, the bargain is off, that, yes, the United States did agree as part of the Uruguay round to forego unilateral action in exchange for a binding dispute settlement mechanism in the WTO, provided that that mechanism did not add to the obligations or take away rights that the United States thought it had under those WTO agreements. And that's at some level what the current administration is contending has already happened by the WTO's appellate body, and therefore, in essence, all bets are off. But when you step back from this, at some level, what the United States is saying to all of the farmers, to all of the companies, to everybody out there is, we're asking you to take your fair share of pain in exchange for getting something better at the end of the day against China. And the problem with that is twofold. One, it's not fair pain. This pain is not being distributed fairly in any way. The Trump administration has picked winners and they've picked losers, and it's not fair. And secondly, it's not at all clear how it's actually directed at China. It's not clear at all how this feeds into some bigger or broader strategy to actually push for meaningful change in China with respect to its subsidies, its technology transfer, its IP theft, the whole litany of difficult issues we have with China. It is not at all clear how this kind of a unilateral tariff strategy is going to in any way move China to change.
The system seems to have been turned on its head, right? On one hand, we have the United States, who helped design the global trade regime as it stands now, acting outside of the parameters of that in a way that, as you just said, doesn't really make sense if there's a coherent strategy. And then China seems to be bolstering the WTO process by actually bringing their challenges into the dispute settlement body. And again, challenging the additional $200 billion worth of goods tariff threats. Let's talk a little bit about the Chinese relationship with the WTO then. I think that'll be helpful context. So China ceded to the WTO in 2001. What was the U.S. position on that accession, and what was the goal of China's accession?
Well, China's accession followed a very extensive period of negotiations, and it was done in a process that is typical, but it involves the drafting of a protocol of accession. In other words, the terms under which China is joining the WTO, this China-specific commitments that China was going to make before it was going to be allowed to join the WTO. So when China joins, it's signing on to the actual rule book, all of the rules that everybody else has signed on to. And in addition, China is taking on a whole series of obligations in its protocol. And at its heart, a lot of what was in the protocol were efforts to try to bring China into a global trading system. I mean, you started out with before China joined the WTO, there was not even necessarily the right to import or export goods. So you had to start out by making China grant a right of both Chinese companies and foreign companies to engage in trade, for full starters. I mean, so a lot of this is beginning at the beginning of setting up a system in China. At the time China joined, there was a good deal of optimism that China was on the path to creating more of a market-based economy. And in fact, for the first 5, 6, 7, 8 years after China's accession, that seemed and was the case, that China was moving in a much more market-oriented direction, opening up its economy, accepting a lot more in terms of goods and services coming in, allowing a lot more joint ventures and foreign direct investment. And then at various points, most effectively recently, China has changed course and has started going in the complete opposite direction with substantially increased amounts of state intervention in its economy. And that's an awful lot of what we're now pushing up against.
So the United States is, on one hand, pushing up against legitimate concerns about Chinese trade practices, as you just said, and on the other hand, muddying the waters with a bunch of other ambiguously directed tariffs against China. It's easy to say that these actions, unilateral actions against China, are attributed to, let's say, ambiguous or abstract desire to corner Chinese trade practices, to dominate China economically, to paint China as a bad economic actor. But do you think there's any more coherent strategy going on?
It's interesting. I will say I don't have a lot of faith in this administration to get this right. I think we need to have a comprehensive strategy, be that militarily, commercially, diplomatically. But I just don't have a lot of faith that this team sort of grasps the magnitude of the issue. They seem to want to litigate fights of the past, and China is more than happy to wage this battle over soybeans and sort of cars, as long as they're left free to continue to pursue China 2025 and dominate high tech. And I think that that's the longer term concern that I just don't see these guys understanding.
What I see very clearly is that most of the world agrees with the United States in terms of the substance of what China is doing and why it is such a huge problem. And no one agrees with the United States tactically.
What do you think the president's rhetoric is doing to future trade negotiations, and or specifically, what's it doing to NAFTA?
My concern is what the president is doing is telling everybody in the world, don't trust the United States. Don't enter into an agreement with the United States unless it has an explicit provision in it that says it will take an act of Congress to get into this agreement and it will take an act of Congress to get out. That is really my concern, is that if you step back from what the Trump administration is doing, is it's undermining any trust or confidence that anybody has that they can take the United States' word for it. And I think, secondly, it is undermining the sense that participation in terms of exerting leadership by the United States in any multilateral forum can be counted on, that the United States can count, that you can count on the United States to assume a leadership role as the world's largest economy, as the largest superpower in the world. We should be the leader at NATO. We should be the leader in the United Nations. We should be the leader at the WTO, and we're not. And the concern is whether and how anybody else then steps up to that leadership mantle in the absence of the United States.
And I think one more question about sort of your personal perspective on what's going on. There's an incoherence within the executive branch. It seems like there are conflicting visions or conflicting strategies coming out of Commerce, out of Treasury, out of USTR. What do you think that's doing to our approach?
Well, it's obviously making it very, very difficult for all of our trading partners, as well as very difficult, I think, for individual companies in the United States and others to figure out what to do. There used to be, again, a very normal, understandable process where things were discussed at the lower level of the Trade Policy Staff Committee, where you started to see proposals get brought up and each of the various agencies that had a role weighing in on it with a lot of the facts, figures, evidence, science, etc., brought to bear. It went through to a higher level of the Trade Policy Review Group. It ultimately was reviewed within the White House at the level of the National Economic Council, so that both everyone in the system and all of the private sector and all of the external foreign governments, etc., were at least aware of where the policy direction was going. Granted, a lot of the deliberations in the end of the day may be kept classified in some way, but the general direction and where and when can you have input? Where and when do you have meaningful input into the policy always used to be clear, transparent, understandable to everybody. And that's not the case now. I mean, every government is struggling with, okay, I don't want to be under the steel and aluminum tariffs. Should I be talking with the Commerce Department about exclusions to my goods or about exemptions? Am I supposed to be negotiating with USTR? Is it actually the Treasury Secretary that is supposed to be running this? And every country that asks that question gets told a different answer at every occasion. And when they get an answer, they're being told by Commerce that they have to do these things in order to come out from under the tariffs. And then when they speak to USTR, it's a different set of things that they have to come out with. And then when they speak to Treasury, they get yet a different set of answers. And all of them are saying, could you please all get on the same page? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
We're not on the same page, and we're not getting on the same page. And it's a problem, not just, again, where is a U.S. company supposed to go? On steel and aluminum, they're told, well, go and apply for an exclusion from your product to be excluded from these steel and aluminum tariffs. And at this point, the view is get in line, because there's over 20,000 petitions ahead of you and less than 100 have been ruled on.
Right.
we saw recently over the last couple of days, China and the EU-China Leadership Convention, which the EU and China made a bunch of commitments to bolstering the global trade regime. And separately, we've seen, let's say last week during the WTO trade policy review, exactly what you just said, which is other countries agreeing with the United States on the substance of their complaints against Chinese trade practices. And then that's sort of the third bucket, is that China is using WTO dispute resolution mechanisms to air its complaints against the U.S. actions, essentially sort of falling in line with the global trade regime instead of acting sort of reciprocally as a rogue country. So what position do you think China's taking, sort of move, looking forward within the global trade regime? And then also let's talk a little bit about the EU and how the EU is positioning itself as both, you know, a repudiator of Chinese practices, but recognizing the value of using China as another major world power to sort of bolster the regime.
Well, again, if you think about what the EU has done in response to a lot of the unilateral actions by the United States, it's done what a number of our other trading partners have done, which is to shore up their relationships with everyone else. So the EU has completed an agreement with Canada. It has enhanced its bilateral agreement with Mexico. It's just completed a major agreement between the EU and Japan, arguably the single largest trade and investment agreement that's been negotiated in the last, you know, 20 years. The EU has said, okay, fine, if you want to, United States, go in this unilateral direction, we're going to go the other way. We're going to open up our market and we're going to open up other markets to EU products. So it's clear they're taking a very different path of fighting for their EU companies through greater access to other markets around the world. And then vis-a-vis China, I think it's very clear that they are trying, on the one hand, to use the rules-based WTO system to hold China's feet to the fire, and again, to try to create the kind of coalition and to use institutions that both the WTO, the OECD, and other multilateral organizations to continue to create a coalition of pressure against China.
So these positions in that sense aren't entirely incompatible, right? The idea that the EU is saying, let's shore up our relationship with other countries and shore up our relationship with China such that the global trade regime is bolstered, is a way to then funnel their legitimate complaints against China through the system that everyone's agreed to.
Yeah, I think if you take a step back, what's really interesting about this is by acting unilaterally outside of sort of the rules-based system, it's the United States, which has legitimate complaints. As Professor Hillman mentioned, we have legitimate complaints. But by acting unilaterally, we become the scofflaws in the eyes of the world, and China becomes the great defender of the WTO and the rules-based trading system. But on the substance, again, we have legitimate complaints. Other countries have these similar complaints. And it gets back to what we discussed earlier, which is the appropriate response from the United States should have been to bring in a whole host of nations that share very similar complaints on IP concerns, tech transfer, and litigate this together, because only through a major bloc like that do you have the leverage and sort of the moral authority to sort of shame China into hopefully changing its trade practices.
So this is a good segue into questions about the WTO more broadly, right? So every country except for the United States, and this is an oversimplified synthesis, but every country except for the United States is looking to bolster the WTO to make sure that it's the proper process for dispute resolution is being used. But the United States is simultaneously undercutting the WTO. What is the actual institution dealing with right now, Professor Hillman?
Well, the United States, I think, has one very broad complaint and then has a very precise tactical approach that it's taking. Its broad complaint is that it thinks the WTO is out of balance, that the relationship between the negotiating arm or the rule-making arm of the WTO has been too weak because the WTO has had a lot of difficulty reaching new agreements. And at the same time, the perception is that the adjudicatory arm of the WTO, its dispute settlement system, including its appeals court, its appellate body, are too strong. And you hear that very clearly in what Ambassador Lighthizer said at the most recent ministerial meeting of the WTO in Buenos Aires in December, where he said, you know, too many countries are using litigation to try to get what they could not get in negotiations. So that is the U.S.'s sort of overarching concern. At a lower level, at a tactical level, what the United States is doing is blocking the reappointment of anyone to sit on the appellate body. the appellate body, its appeals court, is supposed to have 7 members from around the world who sit on that court. They sit for a 4-year term that may be re-upped for a second 4-year term, so a total of 8 years maximum. You've had now 3 members of the appellate body have their term end or leave, such that we're now down to only 4 sitting members of the appellate body. The United States has blocked any effort in Geneva to have even a conversation about a process to appoint any new members. The concern is that as of September, the 4th member of the appellate body's term will be up for reappointment, and no one knows whether the United States will permit that reappointment to go forward or not. If not, the appellate body will be down to only 3 members, and that is the bare minimum that you need to form any given division to hear any given appeal. And it is entirely possible that even after September of this year, that one or more of the members of the appellate body may need to be recused from an individual case, such that you simply could not form an appeals division. And that's very significant because under the rules, you're not allowed to take action while an appeal is pending. So whoever has lost a case can simply file a notice of appeal and then in essence claim that nobody can do anything while the appeal is pending. And if you don't have 3 members of the appellate body to hear the appeal, it can pend forever. Hence, you've now seen a breakdown of the rules-based system because obviously countries aren't going to wait forever for their results. They will start taking unilateral action because the United States has not allowed the appeal system to be up and running and functioning.
If these are the implications of the USTR's stance to the WTO, then why did the USTR file essentially a response claim to all of the countries against whom we're levying 232 tariffs yesterday? It seems like if you're paying lip service to the dispute resolution body, you should at least have faith that it will continue to exist for the period of time during which you need that case to be resolved. What is that all about?
Again, on the one hand, I take great comfort that the United States is still filing cases because it, at some level, it suggests that it is still willing to participate in the system and to use the system when it needs it. And on the other hand, I don't think there's any doubt that what the United States is doing in blocking these appellate body members has the potential to take down the entire system of dispute settlement. And a lot of concern that if you take down the dispute settlement system, you are effectively undermining the whole notion of a rules-based system.
Yeah, I agree with that. One thing I would add is even if you look at the sort of timing on new members of the appellate body, I guess it's by mid-2019, right, that there would be 2 unless something changes.
Well, there's 4 now. At the end of September, if the reappointment is blocked, you're down to 3. And then 2 of those 3, their terms come to an end in December of 2019. So you would now then be down to 1 sitting member. She happens to be the member that comes from China. So you would be down to that 1 person. But under the rules, you must have at least 3 to hear every appeal.
Yeah. And I mean, this is part of, at some level, it's sort of a wither on the vine strategy, just letting the WTO sort of slowly die, even if, you know, there's been internal deliberation that's been reported on lately at the White House about, you know, trying to withdraw from the WTO. It's pretty clear that they do not have the legal authority to do that. But there are other ways of getting to where they want to be, potentially. One is this strategy. I have a concern, and maybe we'll touch on it later, but I have a concern that if the United States were to lose the Article 21 cases, the national security cases, the Trump administration might just say, well, oh, well, we're not going to back down and we're not going to comply with that. And that begins a process of unraveling the WTO in a way that I think is really damaging, because if you had one string to pull to sort of destroy the WTO, it seems to me that the way you would do that would be under the guise of national security. I think that's the broadest exception to the rules. And there's a concern about giving someone at the WTO sort of second guessing the national security concerns of an administration. So I think that those are sort of competing concerns about even if the WTO continues to exist on paper, whether or not it can function.
And we'll talk in more depth about all of the national security elements that are sort of weaved in and out of this almost pure trade law discourse in a second. I'm glad that you brought up the president mentioning wanting to formally withdraw from the WTO. So there were a few weeks ago, we saw, I think it was a leaked version of the Fair and Reciprocal Tariff Act that was a proposed piece of legislation to take us out of the WTO. What was, amongst trade lawyers in sort of the in-the-know community, what was the reaction to that?
I think the reaction was largely that it had zero chance of passing, and that it wasn't clear exactly what it would get you in terms of the reaction to the WTO, because it wasn't formally saying we're going to come out of the WTO. What it was doing, and I think this is something to think about, whether this really is underlying a lot of the Trump administration strategy, is to take away this notion of most favored nation. In other words, if you step back and listen to what Secretary Ross and to some degree the president have said, what they really don't like is the idea that we have to treat countries the same. I mean, they want to discriminate and to give a better tariff deal to our friends, as they define them, and higher tariffs to our foes, let's call it. That seems to be the word of the day. And again, that is not consistent with the WTO, but that's a lot of what this Fair and Reciprocal Trade Act was geared at. It also, I think, was an attempt to push back at the very clear language that's in the Congressional Act when we joined the WTO. The Uruguay Round Agreements Act has a very clear provision that says that if and only if there is a joint resolution of the Congress can there be a formal withdrawal of the United States from the WTO. And I think obviously the president recognizes that he does not have the votes to do that, to engage in what is Section 125 of the Uruguay Round Agreements Act, to formally have a congressional resolution passed to withdraw the United States from the WTO.
I would add that I would actually like to see someone propose this joint resolution, or let's mark up the Fair and Reciprocal Trade Act, because it would enjoy maybe 30 votes in the House. I think it would be a good, in some respects, I see the problem here of playing a game of chicken, but you could see significant pushback from the Congress to the president and sort of serve as a shot across the bow that we're not on board with your protectionist or mercantilist agenda, and maybe that would get him to stop. I don't know. But at some level, I would like to see a formal vote, you know, on something with some teeth to try to push back against the really terrible direction that the Trump administration's taking trade policy.
In some ways, we've seen at least one manifestation of that recently, right? So the tension between Congress and the executive on various points of our current sort of tariff positions is fascinating. Last week, we saw a motion to suggest, right, that Congress wants to claw back authority over these Section 232 tariffs to which we've been alluding. Or for those of you who didn't listen to our first podcast, the Section 232 tariffs are justified by sort of national security concerns, but imposed in ways that economists and trade lawyers alike have said have been sort of not tethered to clear national security justifications. So Congress last week basically said, notionally, we would like to pass a bill that gives Congress more oversight authority over the president's actions when levying tariffs for national security reasons. But as, you know, Clark, you've done some work on this, as you well know, there are a number of bills proposed that do exactly that, that haven't gotten much traction at all. So on one hand, we have, you know, the statement, a symbolic statement that Congress opposes the president's actions, but no actual sort of forceful action. What does that mean?
Right. And what was interesting about what happened last week is if you look at some of the reporting around it, a lot of members of the House and Senate, the vote was in the Senate, but they interviewed various members of Congress, like, if this were a binding resolution, would you support it? And a lot of the folks who said yes to voting for a non-binding resolution were very skeptical of tying the president's hands in a formal way. I think that assumes that the president is sort of playing 4D chess here, and I think everything, all evidence sort of belies that, right? That if you listen to the rhetoric of members of Congress, particularly Republicans, what they say is that the president is trying to negotiate to get tariffs lower and trade balances fixed. And so they're reluctant to kind of hamstring him in those negotiations. And I don't see it. They promised all these bilateral trade negotiations to jumpstart. But the only thing we've formally seen out of the administration is trying to renegotiate NAFTA, which is kind of mired and sort of stuck in the mud at this point. But I'm skeptical that there's going to be any significant pushback.
And part of this is it raises what is the fundamental issue here of the way the Constitution distributes the power over international trade, in that it gives to the Congress and not to the president the authority to regulate foreign commerce. So the reason why the president has gone to these somewhat obscure, not ever used in recent memory, statutes like the 232 National Security Statute or even Section 301 that have not been invoked for more than 20 years is because those are instances in which the Congress delegated to the president this foreign commerce power that resides in the Constitution, in the Congress. The Congress has said, we will hand that power over to you, the president, under these particular circumstances. And some of the pushback that you're seeing in the Congress is, but wait a minute, the circumstances that were set out in those are not the ones that you're now engaging in. I mean, the 232 idea was to say, we do not want the United States to be overly reliant for critical materials on imports from countries that we don't want to trust in a time of war. And yet you look at steel. We only have 20% of total steel in the United States is imported. The number one source of imports is Canada. The number two is the European Union. And number three is Mexico. Number four, Japan. So we are, A, not overly reliant on imports. And to the extent that we are, we're bringing them in from our staunchest allies. So there is not a sort of justification under 232 to impose these tariffs on steel in the first place. So you are seeing that sort of pushback. And when you flip over onto 301, you read that 301 report about what did we say we were complaining about with China. And it's an excellent report. I would highly commend it to everybody that wants to understand what's going on China. And it goes through very carefully this whole series of concerns about technology transfer, about investments in Made in China 2025, about China's attempt to become the world dominant leader in a series of technologies, and about IP theft, etc. But what does the Trump administration do then? They go over to China, and what's the number one thing that they say China has to do? Reduce the bilateral trade deficit with the United States by $200 billion, which has nothing to do with any of the violations that were set forth in this 301 report. So part of, I think, the pushback from the Congress is, yes, we delegated you authority, but you're supposed to use it in these specific ways for these specific purposes. And all you're doing with it is raising tariffs for the sake of raising tariffs. And that is not what the Congress intended. And that is not what they delegated this power for.
I completely agree with that. One thing I would say, though, is that if you look at the statutes, the bills that have been proposed in Congress, they almost exclusively deal with Section 232. I think there's a broad sense in Congress that that Section 232 is being really misused. There's not been as much pushback on Section 301 because I think Congress believes that the methods that they're using may not be great, but it's the right target. I think there's a very serious concern in Congress that, because if you look where this is coming from, it's coming from Bob Corker, who's on the Foreign Relations Committee. Jeff Flake is on the Foreign Relations Committee. So they're hearing it from our allies. And so in some respects, I think it's driven legislative momentum toward the national security side while not doing a ton to push back on Section 301 and potential abuse of Section 301.
What do we think about the potential amendments of 232? So setting aside whether they're likely to pass at all, right? What we're looking at is the immediacy of sort of this need or perceived need for ameliorative steps to address President Trump's, let's say, abuse of 232 discretion. And then a bigger design question, right? Is allocating the powers between Article 1 and Article 2, does it actually make sense in the long run beyond the Trump administration for Congress to claw back oversight powers when the president or when the executive says there is an emergent sort of an exigency here where we need to control our source of steel, aluminum, and other critical supplies? Is that what's the design answer?
Well, again, I think if you think about the way it's been done in terms of this handing over, delegating of the power from the Congress to the president, there has generally been the notion that what you're delegating is the authority to enter into new market-opening agreements with others. So again, you delegate the authority under what used to be called Fast Track, what is now called Trade Promotion Authority, where you're in essence saying to the president, I hand you the power to negotiate agreements. I'd like the agreements to have the following elements in them. We want them to come back with this kind of a set of provisions, and you're setting up a consultation mechanism between the Congress and the White House. Part of, I think, what's the problem here is there's been an utter breakdown in the sort of trust and the communications as between the White House and the Congress. And at some level, I think a breakdown of trade policy making within the administration, where you hear one message from USTR, a different one from Treasury, a different one from Commerce. And there doesn't seem to be a really functioning interagency process that would help the Congress understand exactly where our trade policy is heading. So whatever you think about that breakdown, I think you have to figure out how do you restore a sense of both balance and trust and fair and appropriate communication as between the Congress and the White House around economic policy more broadly.
I completely agree with that. But the concern that I have is long term, I think Congress really needs to think about what kind of role they want to have in trade policy going forward beyond the sort of emergency right now. I'm concerned that a lot of us who spend our time thinking about these types of issues, sort of the balance between Congress and the executive branch over trade policy, are focused too much on the fire right in front of us. It's trying to put out this fire, and then we'll deal with the sort of more philosophical questions about getting that appropriate balance correct at a later date. But they're also this, the sort of environment we're in provides the opportunity, I think, to think about this long term and to try to potentially rebalance it. I think one thing that I would like to see, and I deal with the governance guys at R Street, the project on reforming the way government works, we have sort of an internal debate about this. That on one hand, they like the idea of Congress reasserting its Article I powers. My point is, yes, but I would like to see more roadblocks put in place that would prevent an administration from abusing these processes in the future. So if it's just another step before a 201 case or a 232 or 301 case, that the Congress would have a final vote whether or not we're going to levy tariffs in response to a violation of a trade statute.
So I'm going to take a step back, and I'm going to try to synthesize all of the sort of various threads that have come up during our conversation. I welcome you guys to help me out, but I want to frame this for the benefit of our listeners and sort of like, what does this mean for national security? So on one hand, when it comes to China, we obviously have one of the largest world powers, one of the largest economic and political world powers engaged with us now in what seems like a tit for tat exchange of escalated tariffs and escalated rhetoric. We seem to have started that despite long-term concerns over their unfair trade practices. The unilateral actions, the unique sort of volume of unilateral actions that we're taking now, is putting us in a position where we are both acting sort of on our own, alienating our allies, especially with the 232 segment of those actions, and simultaneously undermining a system that we designed to help stabilize global trade relations. So we, under the guise of, at least in part, national security concerns, have created even more national security concerns for ourselves by isolating ourselves within the trade world. But because these things aren't sort of easily disaggregable, like isolating ourselves politically, real aggravating a major world economic power, imposing those costs on our own people, and simultaneously undercutting the system that could help solve this problem in the long term. And then domestically, what we have is, it seems, clear sort of conversations that need to be had between two branches of government, the executive and the legislative branches, to resolve this issue by coordinating, as you, Professor Hillman, said, as it might have been done better in the past, by coordinating and putting together a coherent strategy in which there are checks and balances. And then, just to mention this briefly, there have been some attempts to appeal to the judiciary, the third branch, to challenge specifically the 232 tariffs. But because of the way that the law is written, those attempts don't seem like they're going to be all that successful. We have yet to see. The most recent case was a case challenging the delegation of power. And so that's a fundamental sort of constitutional question. We'll see how that comes out. But we seem to be in a deadlock. On one hand, even within the executive branch, there isn't a coherent strategy. There doesn't appear to be a coherent strategy. The executive branch and the legislative branch can't agree on what they want to do with at least sort of one segment of these tariffs, what it seems like controversial segment, the 232 tariffs. And then we have a judiciary that might not be able to do anything about it. We're appealing to the WTO dispute resolution body on the international stage, but they're also in very short time not going to be able to do much about this. And our allies are banding together to try to create other solutions that we can't implement ourselves. So all in all, this doesn't seem like only an explicit national security concern insofar as the 232 tariffs go, but an implicit and growing national security situation for us as we further dig ourselves into a period of uncertainty and alienation. Does that sound right?
I think it, unfortunately, to me, yes, it sounds right. And so the question is sort of what can we do about it and where does it take us? At its core, what you're describing, I think, is accurate, which is that the Trump administration, at least, has erased a line between economic security and national security. And at least in my view, that is both wrong as a legal matter and dangerous. The WTO and all of the rules set up under the WTO were largely to govern the issue of economic security and to set up a rules-based system that was predictable, that was transparent, that was fair, that was non-discriminatory, that everybody could be a part of. And so on the one hand, by imposing these 232 tariffs, we're clearly threatening that, because there's no question that what's going to happen at the WTO is there's already been 8 countries that have challenged these 232 tariffs. So this is going to come up in the not too distant future. And all of those countries are going to make all of these claims that these tariffs violate our tariff bindings, and they do. That they violate MFN, and they do. That they violate the requirements in the WTO to be transparent and to have predictability, and they do. So on the merits, all of these countries challenging the United States will and should win. The issue then is the United States will raise a defense that has not before been litigated or adjudicated, which is the national security exception to the WTO. And I say exception very importantly, because this national security provision does not give the United States an affirmative right to assert these duties. All it gives you is an excuse. Yes, I agree that I violated all the rules, but here's my defense. The problem with the defense is the rules on how we describe national security in 232 that blend over economic and national security are not the rules in the WTO. The rules in the WTO are very clear that what falls under this national security exception is trade in fissionable materials, so nuclear materials, trade in arms and ammunitions, or measures taken in a time of war or international emergency. And I don't believe that these steel or aluminum tariffs fit into any of those boxes. So there is coming this very real clash between how we, at least the Trump administration, seems to be characterizing this notion of national security versus what international law and the WTO rules would characterize as national security.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's been a really interesting academic debate on this idea of whether or not Article 21 is quote unquote self-judging. You have taken a position, Professor Hillman has taken a position, that it's not. And there are some legal scholars, Alford wrote a Notre Dame Law Review article that basically, even if it's not in the text, he argues that practically speaking, a WTO jurist is not going to tell a country that this is not in your national security interest. I hope that you are right. And I pray that you are right and that the Trump administration would abide by a negative ruling. But I fear that the United States is going to argue, as you mentioned in your New York Times article or op-ed a month or so ago, in which you said, you know, the United States basically has been consistent about Article 21 throughout its history, but it just recently sided with Russia after Russia imposed all kinds of trade restrictions on Ukraine. Russia came back and said, well, look, you can't, the WTO, you can't do anything about this. Article 21 is self-judging. And the only support they got was from the United States. So there's this inherent trouble I see.
And I think there's a range of views on this. And because there is this Russia-Ukraine debate going on right now, there's a dispute right now in Geneva, I think we will at least hear one panel's take on this before the end of this year. Mm-hmm. And the range is this notion where the United States and Russia are, which is not just that you can't judge, it's that it's not justiciable. I mean, that the moment anyone says, I intend to invoke Article 21, that there's nothing a panel can do. They can't rule on any piece of the case in any way. That's the U.S.-Russia position. If you look at it, then there's a range where, for example, Canada says, well, at a bare minimum, you can ask the question, is your measure because of fissionable materials, or is it because it's trafficking in arms, or is it because there's a time of war? I mean, you at least have to say which box you're in. And to the extent that you're then saying it, do you have evidence that this actually was fissionable materials, or this actually was arms or ammunition? Or if it was taken in a time of war, do you have evidence that there actually was a war between Russia and Ukraine, or in some way a war or other international emergency that caused you to need to put on these restraints? That's sort of, if you will, the medium ground or whatever. And then you go all the way over, for example, to the opinions of countries like the European Union that are indicating that it should be a very fulsome analysis by the panel, focusing very much on this word necessary, which is part of the text. Is it necessary that you impose these restrictions in order to protect your national security? I think if a panel is that invasive, where you have to prove that it was necessary to do this, I don't doubt that there will be a very negative reaction by the United States and lots of others, that that's going too far into judging what is in a country's sovereign right to decide its national security. And on the other hand, I think the United States' position is going too far in the direction of all we have to do is utter these two magic words, national security, and nobody can judge us. Because if you go down that road, every country can put bans, quotas, tariffs on every product and say that they judge it to be in their essential security interest to do that. So you've thrown out a rules-based trading system if you allow that position to prevail.
I saw you and Simon Lester from the Cato Institute on Twitter yesterday raising questions about the most recent U.S. case, which might actually put to the test the U.S.'s extreme position. So with USTR filing charges against the countries that have retaliated against 232, it opens up a possibility, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it opens up a possibility for those countries then to come back at the United States and to say, well, actually, these were national security-oriented tariffs, so that we're invoking GATT 21. And then the United States will be put in a position where they have to say, well, this is our position on 21. It's not justiciable. And then they lose, right? So assuming, I mean, I think setting aside the issue of whether this is going to reach a panel or not, the United States has already put itself in sort of a catch-22 position with this.
Right. Because the United States' position right now is our tariffs cannot be challenged because they're, quote, national security tariffs, as though there is some affirmative right to assert a national security tariff, which is not the case. So the U.S. says our tariffs are national security tariffs. You can't challenge them. But what the EU, Mexico, Canada, Turkey, et cetera, all did by imposing retaliatory tariffs, those can be challenged as illegal tariffs under, again, this same notion of MFN and Article 2 tariff bindings. So they're raising the same complaints that everyone has raised against the United States. And now, again, the United States wants to say you can't do that because your tariffs are not, quote, national security tariffs. They're safeguards or they're some other retaliatory tariff. And you're right. I mean, if these countries are watching what's going on, you're exactly correct. They could very easily assert a national security defense as their basis for imposing the retaliation.
I think one last point that I want to put out there at the sort of synthesis level where we are is that all the while, and you both made this point, I think, in your testimony, the most effective strategy to challenge China's actual unfair trade practices is not being pursued. And so China is in the middle of an exchange of sort of escalating tariffs and, again, political rhetoric with us, but they may actually be sort of let off the hook, relatively speaking, as we take actions that are explicitly aimed at them, but not effective.
And that is the tragedy of what the Trump administration is doing, because they are already causing a lot of pain to all the farmers that are watching prices go down and down and down. We've seen 20 to 25% price reductions across a whole series of farm products that are the subject of these retaliatory tariffs. We've seen, you know, the nail plant in Missouri close because they don't have access to steel. We've seen across the country, everybody that needs steel and aluminum start enduring significant economic pain. And yet we do not have a coherent strategy to actually make China move. And the kind of things that we need China to move on are not easy for China to do. So it's going to take a big amount of pressure and a big coalition and a long-standing, long-term approach to China. And it does not appear that we are getting anywhere even close to that. And that's the real tragedy.
Professor Hillman's exactly right, that there seems to be this belief within the administration that the WTO is inadequate to deal with China's industrial policy of the 21st century. I think that's completely wrong. The WTO is not perfect, but it's the best we've got, and it has a pretty good record. And not only that, I would say that China itself has a pretty good, though not great, record of complying with adverse decisions from the WTO. And it seems to me that these kind of the facts about China's relationship to the WTO just are not penetrating the conversation in the administration. Because if you look at the initial press conference where the president comes out and they announce, look, we're going to challenge the licensing regime at the WTO, we're going to impose investment restrictions, and we're going to put some tariffs on there, the underlying implicit implication is that the WTO is inadequate to deal with this. But I don't think that it's been tried, right? I mean, that's the argument, that their holistic trade practices policy has not been tried before the WTO. Now, there were plenty of reasons, perhaps, that we didn't push an aggressive case during prior administrations. But that's not reason to not try that now before we go down this really, really dangerous path.
I mean, it appears to me increasingly that we're doing tariff for the sake of tariffs, that at some level there are the president simply likes to have higher tariffs in the United States. I mean, some have speculated that they want to create this tariff wall around the United States on the theory that that will make everybody have to manufacture their products in the United States in order to get around this tariff wall. And as we're seeing already, it is having the opposite effect. It is in fact pushing companies out of the United States rather than doing that. But if you go down that road of creating a tariff wall for the sake of a tariff wall, you have clearly taken your eyes off the prize of trying to go after China. And I would totally agree with Clark that we have not tried this big, bold case against China, where we tried to get everyone that has these and shares these very real concerns together. Let the WTO see whether it can work. I mean, try it before you immediately condemn it as not capable or not able to take on a big case. There's a panoply of actual commitments that China made that they're clearly breaking. And there's a broader notion of what is referred to in WTO parlance as a nullification and impairment, meaning it's not a specific violation, but you've nullified the expectations. And clearly the United States and everyone else had the expectation that China would behave as a market economy, and they're not. And that is challengeable as a nullification of our and everyone else's legitimate expectations when China joined the WTO. And that ought to be the thrust of a big challenge against China.
All right. Thank you both very much. This has been a fascinating and important conversation.
Okay. Thanks.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jennifer Hillman and Clark Packard for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done it yet, please, please give us a rating and review wherever you found us, and share us with your friends and followers on Twitter and Facebook. Do not make it difficult for me to figure out how to file a trade exemption petition for automobiles. That is, if I'll need to. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much.
But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.